So without any further ado, I'll turn it over to Ray to introduce himself and talk about some of his work.
And here are our Twitter handles if you want to tweet at us, and the Thinking Social hashtag as well. My name is Ray Junco, and I am a professor in academic development and counseling at Lock Haven University in central Pennsylvania, very sunny central Pennsylvania. Cue laugh. It's kind of like Seattle's sunnier. And I was just there a couple weeks ago. So what I do is, I actually do a bunch of things. My research area is focusing on how social media affects student learning outcomes. And I'm especially interested in classroom applications of social media. I think we've heard quite a bit of talk already about, so how are we, you know, how are we going to do this and whether we should do this or not. I'm beyond the whether we should do this or not. Obviously, many of you here are as well, or else, you know, kind of you wouldn't be at this conference. So Greg and I actually have done quite a bit of research in looking at how to best integrate new media in education. I'm mostly focused on outcomes, although I also am very interested in issues of digital inequalities, which a couple of people have spoke about as well. I can certainly share some of my recent research in that area if folks are interested. But the outcomes I'm most interested in are student engagement, learning, and measuring that through content knowledge, critical thinking, and you know, outcomes such as grades, as well as student persistence, so keeping students in college and keeping them engaged. And these all flow from each other. The construct of student engagement has been shown, you know, in 3-4 decades of research to be related to pretty much all of the outcomes that we'd like to see of a college education. So increase in critical thinking, increase in psychosocial maturity, increase in graduation rates, content and subject level mastery, increase in minorities in STEM fields, et cetera. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the research I've done. First, I'll get into Facebook. And these Facebook studies I'm going to talk about are published. They're available on my blog, and I'll give you the blog website right after this so you can download the papers. Just don't tell the publishers. So this is a summary of a few studies. The first study looked at Facebook and student engagement. And again, large sample sizes. We're talking about 1,800 students. And one of the measures of student engagement is the National Survey of Student Engagement. And yes, that can be argued. We created a scale, a 19-item scale, to measure student engagement in academic and co-curricular activities, because research shows that co-curricular activity involvement is just as important for student engagement outcomes as the academic engagement. So the student who is, you know, talking in class and raising their hand and participating and collaborating with their peers, they're as well off as the students who are, you know, participating in student government, even fraternities and sororities. I don't say that too much, but the benefits are the same. So the NESE scale is an omnibus measure of student engagement. So what I found was I asked students how much time they spent on Facebook and asked them about what they did on Facebook as well. What I found was that increased time spent on Facebook was negatively predictive of student engagement. Now, just a side note, that this is how students use Facebook naturally, right? This is not an intervention. I'm just looking at a cross-sectional approach. It's also correlational. Doesn't mean that Facebook use equals lower engagement. What I also found was I looked at time that students spent in extracurricular activities, which here on this slide I've labeled as involvement. So increased time on Facebook was positively predictive of student involvement in campus activities. Then I looked at what students did while on Facebook. And across the indices, there were 3 indices of engagement. One of them was time spent studying. The other two we've talked about, the NESE scale score and involvement in campus activities. And what I found was that an increase in the frequency of students creating or RSVPing to events or commenting on content was positively predictive of engagement along both of those outcomes, along 3 of those outcomes. and an increase in playing games on Facebook. And I have stalking up here because students call this different stuff. What am I talking about when I say stalking? What do students call this? Creeping, lurking. So checking up to see what your friends are doing on Facebook. These two things were negatively related to student engagement. And then lastly, I looked at how students used Facebook, at least lastly for the Facebook studies. I looked at how students used Facebook and related that to their actual overall GPA. So these were GPAs taken from the university registrars where these students were enrolled. And what I found was that an increase in time spent on Facebook was negatively predictive of GPA. A little caveat to that is that the real-world impact of that was, you know, negligible. Actually, we have two infographics here based on my academic papers, and one of them shows a nice little line graph that shows you how much time spent versus drop in GPA, which is pretty illustrative of real-world impact, maybe not so interesting. What was a really strong predictor, though, was what students did on Facebook. Right, so an increase in posting status updates or posting status updates was negatively related to GPA, while lurking or creeping or stalking and sharing links was positively predictive of GPA. So what's the conclusion from all of those is that, okay, well, time spent on the site, you know, there's some relationships to some outcomes there. But what's really important is what students do on the site, okay? Shocking to those of us in the room, right? So those were correlational studies. And so, you know, you really want to have some kind of experimental design, some kind of controlled study. So Greg and I did some research on Twitter. And for our controls, we randomly assigned students, first-year students in first-year seminars, to sections that were going to use Twitter as part of the course, and then other students to what we called control sections, which used Ning to get the same information. So we wanted to make sure they were equivalent in terms of information and contact with us. And what we found over the semester, the students who used Twitter had significantly increased engagement. And again, that's on this infographic here, and you know, I'll show you where you can get these papers. And what was really surprising to both of us, especially me, Greg wasn't as surprised as I was, that our Twitter group had significantly higher GPA. So we thought, wow, that was really, really interesting. We wanted to, you know, kind of delve into that a little bit more. So we also did a one-year follow-up where we interviewed students and we also looked at their retention, their second-year persistence rates. So how many students stuck it out into their second year that were in the Twitter group versus in the control group? And what we found that those in the Twitter group were significantly more likely to be retained. It was an 80% versus a 70
versus 87.
70 versus 87, thank you, percent in retention rates. So 87% of our Twitter group stuck around, 70% of our control group stuck around. So we also have some qualitative data based on interviews. We can get into that if you're interested, but they're kind of beyond the scope of this introduction. If you'd like the papers, I post them at blog.rayhunko.com. I'm always working on something. However, I only post the PDFs once they've been accepted for publication. I know I'm kind of a little bit traditional in that sense, but I am looking for a job at a research institution, so I kind of have to play the academic rat race game. So with that, I will hand it off to my colleague, Greg.
All right, great. Thanks, Ray. I want to set the stage a little bit in terms of how I think about higher ed and how I think about what we're doing with technology. And I work at South Dakota State University. I coordinate our pre-med program, and I teach in that program. So I've been able to, throughout my career, work in student activities as well as academic affairs, and I think in every setting, looking for ways to innovate with technology. One of the things that I think about when we take new students into the university is I think about that orientation experience, that registration experience. And historically, that looked like, and as many of us experienced, going to a large assembly, hearing faculty or administrators tell us about the fact that college is really tough, and look to your left, look to your right, one of you will be here next year, one of you will actually graduate. You know, that kind of rhetoric was a part of what we were doing historically in higher ed, and I think our rhetoric is changing. But I don't know that our outcomes are. So this is some data from Complete College America, and I think as we look at where we're at, and we look at the graduation rates, the retention rates. Sure, we orient students, and we have bright, shiny things for them to have and see when they come to orientation or on admissions visits. And we talk a pretty good game right now in higher ed about wanting to retain students. But there hasn't really been a significant shift. And there's multiple reasons why that is. And we can certainly talk a little bit more about that as we get into the Q&A. The other thing I think that's interesting, you know, NESI and all of the engagement and involvement research really was based on research that was done in the 70s, 80s, and through NESI in the 90s and 2000s. And so we really thought about, as higher ed, we thought about engagement as this face-to-face interaction. So students getting together at the library and studying, students going to their faculty members' office hours, students living on campus, this really traditional process, and retention models are built around that, and our engagement models are built around that, and I think that we're obviously seeing a shift there. Currently, you know, we're doing all kinds of things to try and increase retention, but we're certainly very focused on that traditional student. So we create first-year seminars, we create remediation programs, and we have multiple ways that we're looking to increase that time on task with students on campus through supplemental instruction, tutoring, those kinds of things. And I think a lot of traditional campuses miss where we're going and what some pieces of research are showing and aren't integrating that yet. And so I think we need to really think about co-opting this new technology, because as Ray showed you, research supports the fact that you can use these free technologies, these social media pieces of technology to increase engagement, to increase retention, to increase learning. And I think that's something that's been missed in a lot of settings. I think one of the things that, as we found this retention data to be so compelling, to really think about where we're going, and this Complete College America program has come out with some really great data, pushing governors and pushing states to really think about retention and graduation rates in a new way. And I think this idea that the majority of students are non-traditional, and that we're not counting them. So when we count our graduation rates, when we talk about student persistence, when a campus posts that on their website and students try to use that to compare campuses, they're really only talking about students that are living in their residence halls, that are full-time students, that are traditional students. And we're seeing across the board a huge shift in higher ed, and I think we're needing to think about this new technology and things like Twitter and Facebook and how to utilize them to continue to stay connected with students when they're not on our campuses. Our LMSs, and our research shows this, are not doing that. Students are not using LMS products to stay connected with each other. They're not using it to even stay connected with their faculty. They're using it to organize the content of the course, which is a really great thing. Technology's really helped us to do that, but we need to really think about how we can continue to move in a positive direction in terms of student engagement and where our students are going. Tinto's model of student departure is really where we have kind of framed our discussion and our thoughts around what's going on with our interventions. So when we talk about Twitter and how it increased student engagement and retention, there are lots of factors that go into whether a student decides to stay or leave an institution. And there's lots of pre-entry factors. Those include ACT and their commitment to college and their support from home and all of these outside factors. There are the goals that they create, and those things we do have a little bit of an impact in. So this model is much more complex than I'm showing here, but the things that I'm showing are the things that we as administrators, as faculty, as advisors, as student affairs practitioners have an opportunity to interact with. So we can't, in a lot of cases, control the... I'm at a large four-year research institution that's land-grant. We have a pretty open admissions policy. I can't control necessarily all of the students that are recruited in terms of their ACT and GPA and some of those previous factors, but I can help them at orientation to help and throughout first-year seminar to set some goals and really have some intentionality about their experience in higher education. The academic system has two components, and I think in terms of technology, we've, in the last 20 years, really put all of our money and all of our focus on the academic side, and in terms of technology, haven't always been that great or that innovative on the extracurricular side or the informal and social side. So this chart kind of shows the academic at the top there, and those are places that our faculty and staff can interact with students and really help to get them integrated into the institution. But again, these extracurricular things. So one of the things that I look back on our Twitter study, it's not that we had a back channel going on in class. It's not that we were using this to communicate with students while we were there. Both Ray and I think, are both on the same plane here. When we have students with us, we want to be working with them. And that's not to say that technology can't be a part of that. But what we really used Twitter for was continued communication, because they tend not to come to my office hours. Mm-hmm. They tend not to call me on the phone. They might send a short email, but this was a great way for us to connect. And so I think that bottom blue box with extracurricular activities and peer group interactions was really a place that we saw really great interaction between students, between us as faculty and students. And this all really leads to their end intentions and their end goals and outcomes, and whether they're retained and whether they graduate. And so I think that this model for me helps me to think about what happens to college students as they make a decision about sticking around, and it's definitely a research supported model as well, and I think it fits well with the research that we've done. So That's a little bit about how I think about retention, how I think about social media, but certainly we can go there again with your questions, as I'll turn it over to Ed, and he'll talk a little bit more about it in terms of the practitioner side.
Okay. And actually turning it over to me.
Turning it over to Liz. And I should add that one thing, based on what Greg said, that we use Twitter in specific ways, and so we actually have a new paper that's out where we compared using Twitter in two different ways in different classes, right? And so typically when you hear about faculty integrating Twitter in their class, it's a back channel kind of thing, right? And what we found was that using it as just a back channel thing doesn't do much. So there were no effects for engagement. There were no, learning outcome differences. There were no GPA differences in the students who used it that way. But if you used it in ways where you integrated it in what we call educationally relevant ways into the curriculum. So not only do students have to use it a certain way, but we have to use it a certain way too. And we actually detail those in our latest paper, which is on my blog. Yes. Okay, back channel is kind of what we're doing now. If you're on the Thinking Social back channel, what professors typically do when they use Twitter in class, they will either lecture and let students, kind of talk in the background. So it's like an ongoing chat that's separate from what's going up, happening on stage, or they project it up on a screen. And so they're lecturing and they react to it too. As you might imagine, this works, at least that model kind of works better for professors and I'm using better loosely here, in larger lecture courses where it's harder to, integrate all of the commentary that might be brought out. So that's a very popular way to use it in college classes, whereas what we found was that doesn't really have much effect for outcomes. So here they are using the technology, here they are using it in a way that kind of seems cool, and, like it might benefit them, but in reality there's no benefit in terms of outcomes for that. Yep, and we have some data on that.
Well, my name's Liz Gross. I am the Marketing and Communication Director at the University of Wisconsin Waukesha, which is a very small two-year campus. We focus on providing a high-quality, accessible freshman, sophomore liberal arts experience with transfer to four-year campuses. Given that our mission is accessibility, our tuition is the lowest in the UW system, which translates to a very small budget for the Marketing and Communications Office. So over the last year and a half to 2 years or so, I've been playing around with Facebook ads to try and up the ability for our campus to directly market to our target audience, about 75% of which is traditional college students in a one-county area. So it's very, very targeted. But my marketing budget is very small. I have less than $50,000 a year to recruit the students that come to our campus, and that's over 2,000 students. So I looked at my Facebook usage for 3 months out of this year, and specifically it's November 17th to February 17th. And on those 3 months, I used Facebook ads to get 14 million impressions with my target demographic, 1,000 clicks, and only spent $1,260. I can delve into these figures I'm working on how to figure out how that correlates to increased enrollment and more exposure to our campus, because we have a little bit of lower name recognition because there's 25 other large UW institutions that have more name recognition than us. But what I really was interested in finding was how this compares to what I would call traditional online advertising. We definitely want to be online because we know that's where our students are. But before the advent of social media, online advertising meant partnering with a local news outlet to advertise on their website or doing Yahoo or Google ads. And when I talk about traditional online advertising, it's those 300 by 300 pixel display ads that many of you probably never see because you have ad blockers installed on your browsers. But we purchased some just to see if we could increase our reach. And I compared our traditional online advertising that we ran through August through December with our Facebook ads run during the same time. And I found some very, very interesting comparative data there. Our Facebook ads during that 5 month period, which actually only 3 months out of that I actually ran Facebook, had 8 million impressions. Our traditional online ads had 218,000 impressions. Our Facebook ads had 553 clicks. The traditional online ads had 169 clicks. What really got interesting is the cost comparison. When you buy an online ad, you pay for every 1,000 impressions. That's your CPM. And our cost for every 1,000 impressions of the traditional ads was 154 times that, what I paid for 1,000 impressions on Facebook. And if you're more interested in who's clicking on our ads, our cost per click for those traditional ads was 13 times the cost of our Facebook ads. And then when you look at my overall ad buy, seeing that Facebook had a larger reach and a larger interaction rate with our audience, I paid 4 times as much for the traditional ads as I did for the Facebook ads. So I think if you're interested in marketing your institution or integrating social media into your recruitment practices, Facebook is definitely where there is bang for your buck. I've concluded that Facebook has a larger reach, and you're able to reach your targeted audience at a much more affordable price. So mostly I'm looking at this from the marketing side. I do want to throw in a plug that I'm also a PhD student working on extending the research that Ray and Greg are doing. So hopefully next year or the year after when I come to South by Southwest, we'll be able to look at the student engagement data, which we know is highly predictive of student success and student retention, and look at how students communicate with their faculty, college staff, and peers impacts their student engagement. So outside of the classroom, does it matter if they're using social media or going to face-to-face office hours or communicating via other electronic methods like email or IM? Does that have an impact on their student engagement and hopefully those other important outcomes? So in a couple years, I'll be able to talk about that, but today I'll be focusing mostly on marketing.
Yeah, we have some, you know, to segue from that to Ed, we have some new unpublished data we're working on in the paper right now where we interviewed these students in the Twitter study for the follow-up, and, you know, we asked them about the ways they use technology, and unanimously they said that they would rather use Facebook as part of their courses, right? And why would they want to do that? I'm going to ask you. I know the answer. I'll give you the answer, but let's see if you know. So incredibly basic, right? They're used to it. They're always there, right? My research shows that they spend an average of an hour and 40 minutes a day on Facebook, right? So that's what they told us. We're always there. We can get the notifications easily. We know how to use the platform. It's easy to interact with each other. You don't have to go finding people, you know, and then, you know, there's some other issues that came up about the LMS. But, yep, that's it.
I'm going to turn it over to Ed.
Thanks. Well, good morning. My name is Ed Cabellon, and I work at Bridgewater State University in lovely Bridgewater, Massachusetts, which is about 35 miles south of Boston in the Northeast. And I've had the opportunity to work with these fine folks in terms of looking at how I can use the research that they've done, as well as some of the data that they've shared with all of you today, and how do you get that to the folks making decisions about integrating social media in the work that you do. As a higher ed administrator, I'm director of the campus center there, and I work in student affairs. Using social media for me was a no-brainer 3 years ago, and as an early adopter, I knew that I had to really get into this so that I could find ways to better connect with our students. And what I found over the last 3 years of using social media to engage our students and to keep them informed and to really engage them in conversation, we found more students out there that we didn't have a chance to connect with before. So we saw a lot of different types of students come out because of our engagement on social media platforms. Before that, it was just traditional students who were either in the residence halls or those Uber-involved students who were going to be at your events or at your stuff anyway. Now, with social media, we're able to connect with other types of students that we just didn't have that opportunity before. And so in terms of my interests in social media and higher education, things such as digital identity education are very important to me. And what I mean by that is trying to get students to look at their digital footprint and get beyond a Facebook brain. And so when you talk about integrating Twitter or integrating other social media tools, their frame of reference from the very beginning of social media is social. You know, they don't realize how powerful these tools can be. And whether we need to do more work at the high school level or, you know, maybe during orientation programs or what have you, it's important that we move them beyond that and look at how they can use it for other things professionally, you know, in the learning sense. And so that's something I'm very interested in, as well as looking at how we can measure their literacy with technology. Because I think with the liberal arts education today, it's important that we're teaching technology to our students and not just assuming that they're natives to this and that they know how to do it. Because again, their framework has been social. And so we really want to use these technologies. Somewhere along the line, there has to be an educational component to get them to think beyond social. When I look at the challenges that we've had along the way, budget cuts are something that all of us have experienced. I work in a public higher education institution. We've experienced cuts in Massachusetts, much like a lot of folks. Are there any folks who work in state higher education here today? Okay. Have you all experienced budget cuts as well? I don't want to assume, I guess. Okay. And so, you know, we've had to do a lot with a little. And, you know, when you think about how you keep up with the demand of the growing number of shiny tools, of the things that, you know, our students are getting into and trying to understand what do we pick from all of the things, we've always gone back to Facebook and Twitter. And we've had to be creative in terms of utilizing campus collaborations with our IT departments, with our marketing folks, with our communication folks, tap into students who are studying this and maybe using it for internship opportunities. We've had to create campus committees to be able to have the same voice and the same conversation throughout. And so at a time where we can't hire anyone specifically to manage this, the community has had to come together and we just try and find one another in terms of who's using this really well and try and train those who are interested in it. And that includes our faculty as well, because I know some of them have been interested in wanting to use that as well. When I think about trying to get my administrative colleagues to look beyond what they see when they think of social media, I want to move beyond the customer service component. I want to move beyond marketing. And that, when I think about that, I think about, you know, the marketing for events on campus, not the stuff that Liz was talking about earlier, so to be clear. When I think about the participatory nature of social media, I want to move us beyond that, because I think that's on the surface what most people see, what most people have done, whether it's liking a page, getting fans, getting followers, and really looking at the things that Greg and Ray have talked about in terms of engaging and really trying to make connections for our students who don't come to our campus. Bridgewater State has a very high commuter population, so I'm always interested in trying to figure out ways to connect with students who aren't physically in our spaces every day, because those are going to be active alumni. They're going to be folks who you're going to want to connect with. Those of you in development are going to want to connect with to get donations after they graduate. And if they're not feeling like they're a part of your community, then it's going to be harder to do that. And so with the rise of online learning happening as well, these are the things I want us to think about. And I'm gonna quickly end by sharing a story about my interactions with Twitter, because 3 years ago, I was one of the naysayers. I didn't believe in it. I thought it was dumb. I saw no purpose for it, for myself or for my students. But I got on it because I had to see for myself. I didn't want to use the media's picture of how Twitter was for folks. I wanted to experience it for myself. And so what I did was I searched on Twitter during orientation for keywords in Twitter: Bridgewater State, BSU, BSC. And this tweet was one that really stood out. It was from a student who was a commuter, female, first year, said, "Surprise, surprise, the BSC bookstore also sucks. They didn't have all my books, and the lady was all annoyed by me." Now, as an administrator, if I'm walking down the hall or if I'm walking down the street and I hear that, of course, the first thing I'm going to say is, "Oh my God, what's the matter? I'm so sorry. This is your first experience on our campus. How can I help?" So I did it digitally. I followed her on Twitter using my own account and the campus center's account. And the next tweet that came out: "LOL, two BSC official Twitters are following me. I wonder if they know so much I trash talk the school." Uh-huh. Yeah, I did. Yeah. So, so I tweeted her again, and I said, "Yep, totally, it's okay, no worries, great blog, by the way." And so with some of our students that I've found who use Twitter now, and initially they use Twitter because they're trying to get away from Facebook and create Facebook Lite by making their tweets private and having a small community. This woman had using Twitter with a bio and had her blog. So I read some of her first blog posts. She was a great writer. And so I wanted to make sure I paid attention to that. Just something simple. 140 characters, what can you say, right? Well, the next tweet.
Watch, whoa. Ed.
I know. "Whoa, I just gained like 10,000 respect points for BSU. Thank you." Okay, forget everything I ever said bad about BSC. They DM'd me and claimed to have read my blog. Feeling much better about the school now. And so for as many of these conversations that I've missed or that have not gone positive, okay, if we're not in the space and we're not listening, we're not going to have the opportunity to engage our students with this. Because, frankly, they don't believe anyone's listening. I mean, as they use Twitter, they tweet as if they text, and they're not realizing its implications. And so it's important that they realize we're listening. And, again, for this story, I mean, this story has a happy ending, because this woman ended up becoming my first student blogger for our department, and now she's my editor-in-chief. And as a commuter student, if we didn't have this interaction, I don't know what her involvement at the institution mm-hmm. would be. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not saying this is how it's going to be for everybody, but certainly this raised my awareness to the fact that there is a place for Twitter in higher ed if you understand its lexicon, understand its functionality, and using data and research, pitch it to the folks who are making decisions, saying there are ways to engage our students with this. We just need to up our own game and understand it better. And so thank you. She said thank you, and she came into my office, and the rest is history. And so as you think about the administrative component of social media in higher education, it's important to understand the research that's been done, the ton of research that still has to be done, and how administrators use it now. I always tell my colleagues that if you're not using it for yourself, personally, professionally, then it's going to be very hard for you to fully understand its nuances when you're trying to pitch it or train students or train staff when you're going to ask them to do it. And so if I see a lot of folks using Twitter for the first time as a department account. And I think to myself, why are you doing that as your first entry point into Twitter? Because you still don't know, all the nuances and lexicon of it. So I would encourage all of you, if you're not on Twitter yet, to get involved in Twitter and these other pieces. I'm going to turn it back over to my colleagues for questions.
And that was a great connecting point for everything that we've talked about, because we know that student connection to the institution is a powerful force in student persistence, right? Greg and I talk about this all the time. We have a red flag that raises when a student tells us, "Oh, I go home every weekend." Right? That to us, they may be an A student, but that to us is a student at risk, because they are not connected to their social networks at the institution. So what Ed did was, through media, engaged a student, had them connect to somebody. Some of our recent research shows that the students who stayed had more rich connections with either faculty or staff on campus than those who left. So it's very, very important that those connections be made. And Ed's example is a perfect one of how we can use media to do that, and what our vibe and philosophy is, that face-to-face is very important. Interpersonal relationships are very important. And as we can use technology to bolster or create those connections, the better.
So as you can see, we have a wide variety of interest areas and practical applications. So at this point, if you have any questions about anything we've talked about or something we didn't talk about that you wished we did, I'd like to invite people to the microphone and question away.
Or just question from your seat.
I think they're recording us.
Oh, they're recording. Can I beatbox now?
Hi.
Hey. This is really nice. I love research-based stuff, you know, rather than pontificating from nowhere.
Thanks. We do, too. We're data geeks.
My name is Honoria, and I teach at the Art Institute of Austin. And I know that my students, because I teach at an art school and they're very visual, I know they spend a lot of time on Facebook, which, whether visual or not, they do, and they post their work there. And so I follow my students and comment there. But I was wondering about Twitter and the Twitter photographs and stuff, if people who are working with visual material use Twitter as much as Facebook. And the other question is how do you actually set the expectations of using these things in the beginning? Like, is it in your syllabus? And what are your specific, you said you had specific
yes.
things on your blog, but I'd like to hear a little bit about them.
Yes. Well, question number one, there is no research about visual versus non-visual people and how they use social media. In terms of outcomes and quantitative research, what we've shared with you today, plus maybe less than a handful of other articles, is what you know is what's out there. In terms of, but I can take you know I can take the 30,000 foot view, and something we think about a lot is that there are some synergies between the technologies and how you use them. Some technologies are better suited for certain things, right? You're not going to use Twitter to post a video. You're going to use YouTube, right? I mean that's a really basic one, but I think in terms of what you're talking about. Yeah, Facebook would make more sense in terms of posting pictures. Quite honestly, posting pictures on Twitter is cumbersome, right? So that's part of the issue. We can distill based on our research. Again, you know, I don't like pontificating. Whenever I hear best practices, people say best practices, I go, oh, fuck. They're gonna just BS it up, right? So for me, I get itchy, right? So best practices to me have to do with something you have tested empirically and have found either to work or not work, right? So we have limited evidence, but evidence, to show that one thing you must do is make it a course requirement. Make your social media use a course requirement. You have to be very clear about your expectations, right? And what we believe in, and which is part of Chickering's idea of a good undergraduate education, is you have to set high expectations, right? So that's number one. And you have to do that early on. And for everything. I mean, and not just social media use, but you have to really be explicit with your students about what you expect from them at the very beginning. When I go over my syllabus, I say, this is my contract with you. This is how we're going to do it. I'm a nice guy, but when it comes to turning stuff in late, you're screwed. And you are going to come, you know, a couple of people going to, you know, test me on this. I give you a zero if you turn in something late. If you tell me before the fact, fine, no problem. Get it to me. We're good. But if you just come in later and my dog ate it or this and that, sorry. Right. So that's my expectation and setting a high expectation for them. So number two, you have to integrate it. You have to integrate the social media in ways that are relevant to your curriculum. Right. Our curriculum had a lot of discussion. We did a lot of discussion on Twitter. That's, you know, so it has to make sense from a pedagogical standpoint, right? You'd be surprised because the folks in this room get it. But most faculty think that just integrating the technology is going to be it, right? Like the technology is the magic bullet, right? Of course, you expose people to technology and they're going to learn. Absolutely not, right? If you went to to Craig Watkins' talk, he was talking about digital divides and more exposure to technology. But there's clearly data to show that just exposure in terms of digital divide does not mean digital equality. There are actually still digital inequalities. I actually have some new data about Facebook and how people from minority backgrounds and those from lower SES backgrounds use Facebook differently than their majority peers. So I think that's important there too. Do you want to say some more?
I think you were at 2 points. I think the third one for me definitely has to be you have to train students, and I think that's kind of where you were leading, is that we can't assume that students know how to use Twitter. We had a group of students and none of them were using Twitter before this intervention, and so whatever the new technology is, I think you've got to set those ground rules. You have to use it in educationally relevant ways, but you also have to realize that you need to train them all, and there needs to be some consistency in how that's delivered.
And I actually have some platform-specific thoughts for your use. Facebook students know how to use, but if your students are posting their original visual works, they might be better suited to use something like Flickr, where they can license the work so people can't snag it as quickly, or investigation into the newest thing that I'm refusing to use because it's going to distract me from my dissertation.
Pinterest
might work for that specific use.
Pinterest.
It's interest with a P in front of it.
I'm not Pinterested in you, Liz.
It's totally visual, and for that specific use, it might make sense.
Yep.
Where we have come up with issues using Pinterest right now is they completely lose all liability for anything you post that might be copyrighted, but if it's the student's own work, that might also be a really great place for it.
So the third best practice was that you have to engage with them on the platform. Don't just leave them alone. So you leave them alone to the back channel, nothing. Guide them, just like you guide them in their learning, right? So if you ask them a question and they give you an answer and you're like, how did you get to that answer? Well, let's think about this a different way. Same thing with the social media. Yeah, question. That's fantastic.
Sharing.
That's wonderful. You're one of very few who are doing that. Yes. And I just posted this. I know it's a lot to read. This is right out of the publication. The publication is called Putting Twitter to the Test, Assessing Outcomes for Student Collaboration, Engagement, and Success. I like alliteration and rhyme. if you were here earlier, you know I like the rhyme and beatbox. And I think I'm good at it is the really funny thing.
He is.
Yeah, thanks, Ed. That's very nice of you. So here are just some examples. I mean, these were the ways that we use Twitter in the comparative study, and you'll see there's about 11, maybe more different ways, and they were continuity for class discussion, giving students a low-stress way to ask questions, because remember, these were first-year students, right? And so they always feel like, oh, is this a dumb question? I realized very early on in my work that if you gave students a digital medium to ask questions, they're much more likely to be involved and active in class. I think that kind of our research grew out of that from when I started teaching, you know, eons ago. To talk about the book, because they all shared across all the sections, they read a common reading, so we had them discuss that. We sent out class reminders and campus event reminders. So it was really interesting because right after I left, because we trained students on how to use Twitter, and then I left, there was a campus event reminder about this Cuban poet who was going to be at this institution, which is in the middle of nowhere, and I was sure I was the only Cuban who had ever visited this town and was so disappointed to hear through the Twitter feed that one of my peoples was going to be there. So we also provided academic and personal support, and there were some interesting things that happened in that space, because not only did students collaborate academically, but they collaborated personally and socially. One student suggested that they were going to hurt themselves, and another student said, and I'll never forget this tweet, she said, I don't know you or anything, but you don't sound like you're doing so well. And we didn't see this. I didn't see this until later. I was off site. I got in touch with Greg. I said, hey, you need to bring this student in. And that other student reaching out meant so much to that student. And very much like she said, these were two that you would never think would travel in the same circles. So that was really interesting. We helped them connect to each other and to us. And we have some interesting findings in terms of the follow-up interviews. Organizing their service learning projects, organizing study groups. We had them do some assignments on Twitter, optional and required assignments on Twitter as well. Yes.
Yes.
The ultimate goal, peace. everybody having enough. You're right. This is I'm in my little, you know, kind of myopic place in the world where I focus on student engagement and I focus on supporting students to help them graduate, because I have the lofty idea that that will improve people's station in lives, that within, you know, one generation you can change the outcome of a family when you educate them. So that's the distant goal. And then the even more distant goal was, I'm not joking, peace and, you know, goodwill and everybody having enough and less of a focus on, you know, accumulating material things and more of a focus on each other. So there, you caught me. I'm a hippie. Michael, what's up?
Hey there.
Hey, you hate panels, man. Did this suck or what?
No, actually, it was kind of fun. Yeah.
You could say it sucked, bro.
No, not all right. At all. Maybe I loved it because I was very familiar with the content. So, mm-hmm. You talked a lot about the use cases around Facebook and Twitter. And so when you talk about Twitter as a back channel for the classroom, you know, I can think of a company, Piazza, which is very specifically trying to create this question and answer based back channel for the classroom. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about, you know, an easy, familiar-to-use interface instead of a clunky learning management system, I can think of entrepreneurs like CourseKit that are building specifically this thing, right? And when you talk about using this to build community for students that are in the process of enrolling to increase the likelihood of retention, well, that's actually something that I do. So I wonder how you guys think about basically people like me, right, mm-hmm. who are listening to these issues and saying, hey, I want to, you know, build a technology that specifically addresses this, mm-hmm. Rather than vis-a-vis, you know, Twitter and Facebook and these kind of very horizontal tools that are trying to be applicable to everybody and mm-hmm. not specifically education.
Michael, can I jump in first? Because he knows where I'm coming from on this, and I want to share. Would you like to tell people what you do?
For clarification,
yeah.
I did say this in the question. I started a company that makes what we call the Schools app, and our focus is on kind of the enrollment management process and mm-hmm. building community with students on the way into school and as they get there, with the idea that that increases the likelihood of persistence and graduation. Yeah.
Thanks. Well, yeah. You know how I feel about this. You are... probably the only one in that space who's talking to us, right? I mean, you have reached out and said, okay, what do the researchers, what does the research show? How can we integrate what the folks in education are doing into our apps? Nobody else is doing that, right? So that's my issue, you know, one issue with folks who are trying to do this, right? Sometimes it feels like trying to reinvent the wheel. Right, like, why try to do something like Twitter when there is a Twitter, right? Or it seems like, oh, I had this issue in college, so I'm going to develop a product to address students with that issue in college. And hey, that can be a real hit. But I think one, there's a lot of people getting into the space now. So that's an issue. I think we need to find some sort of balance about user base and usability, because our students are clear to tell us, oh, that's another thing we have to do, right? So instead of, you know, if they're already on Twitter, great, we use Twitter. Clearly, they're telling us Facebook. I mean, that's part of the reason why, you know, your app is where it is, because we know that students use that. So I think it's that issue of having some kind of user base, and maybe that's not fair, right? Because then if I say that, and I'm just thinking out loud here, that what I'm saying is only the big players get to play in the game, and in my heart, I don't believe that should be the case, but I think that there are a lot of missed opportunities because the EdTech startup people aren't communicating with us. Mm-hmm. And any communications I ever have with EdTech startup people go something like this. It's a random email that says, hey, Ray, we like your stuff. Doesn't say anything about my stuff. You know, I appreciate compliments, but you know, maybe they've never even seen my work. Damn, double, triple entendre. I didn't even get that. And then it's like, would you mind taking a look at our product and giving us some feedback? And my answer is, fucking really? What do you think I do all day? Wait around for an email from an EdTech startup? You know, here's my consulting rate, and they never, ever write me back, right, when I share my consulting rate, right? I've done that with you because, you know, I like you and you have good hair. But, yeah, you know, we talk about that
a lot.
Yeah,
it actually does.
So you know, I think that's an issue, right? And I think one of the things that that I think would be exciting, and I'm just, you know, kind of speaking at least for Greg and I here, would be to be in at the beginning of that. Right. Let's plan one of these projects together based on some sound theories about student retention and student success. Okay, I'm going to stop talking this.
Sorry. When I think of your basic question of do we want to send students to these large platforms that are public and not specific to education, or do we want to work with these people who are trying to help us create social connections online in education. When I think about how I mentor and advise students, I want to help them build a digital presence that's going to help them when they leave. And if that digital presence is on Facebook or on Twitter or on a blog, I absolutely support it. If it's stuck in a system that they lose access to when they leave the institution, I don't feel like I've served them well. So I really appreciate the startups who are working at integrating those technologies and helping students build that presence through the social networks that employers are going to look at when they want to hire them. So when I think of our students' interests for their graduation and employment, that's the one thing I want. I want them to be able to use the tools that they're going to use when they leave. That's my own opinion. Might not make friends with that.
And by the way, I should add that you heard my bit of crankiness and attitude about the random EdTech startup emails, but if you're a graduate student or a researcher or another faculty member or someone at a higher ed institution, you get my time, right? Because you're not trying to make money off of my idea. So
hello, my name's Hi. Brian Dannon. I'm from Georgia Tech. And speaking to your point, how do you feel about sort of student privacy issues? Because we had an issue where we had to remove a bunch of blogs because it had students' names and what classes they were in, what classes they took. And those aren't allowed to be sort of out there publicly. So how do you deal with that when you're trying to retain the information so that maybe employers can actually look at it?
I have a feeling Ed's going to have thoughts on this too. But my really quick answer is if it's the student's content, I don't get involved. If it's
Correct.
The student's content on a service that's
yep.
their own, not my issue.
Mm-hmm.
When they're doing that on our systems, then that's where the expectations in advance come in. And if they violated those expectations, down it goes. But I wonder if Ed has more interesting thoughts.
No, that's exactly what I was going to say. You nailed it. I mean, the challenge is, again, the administrative perspective of social media, including blogs, where control is going to be the thing that they first go to. When you talk to our IT friends, it's the first thing they think about is security and how are we going to make sure this is safe for our campus and it doesn't, you know, screw any of our systems that we've worked very hard to set up. And so when you talk about the information that students are sharing, if it's their own blog and they're sharing stuff, you're right, we don't get involved. And you know, if it's in a classroom setting, you know, that's stuff that, again, setting the expectations ahead of time and, again, creating the educational opportunity for those students to know that this is for a class or this is for something, and making sure that they know what they can put up there and what they can't, or what they should, I should say, can versus can't is tough, but is important. I think that's a missing step because the instructors who are using technology aren't using it themselves, or they've never seen WordPress. So what does that mean? And what does all this mean? And so whatever blog platform they're going to use, whether it's in-house or not. And so I agree with Liz 100% that we can't control everything because it's not possible.
It seems like we didn't answer your question fully based on what you said on Twitter. Can you say more than I may not have understood? Yes. Yep. Let me get a slide for you. Let me get a slide for you while we take a breather.
I'll take that. As an administrator, when I think about engagement, and you know, I work in student affairs and student life, and so I want them to be involved with the campus community in a plethora of ways. Whether it be volunteer, student employment, study abroad. I mean, something beyond a co-curricular opportunity that's outside of the learning that they're doing inside the classroom. Being engaged for me means that they're gonna be more satisfied with their educational experience. They're going to feel connected to the overall campus community, and that when they graduate, a measure of that is are they giving back to the institution in some way, shape, or form? Are they recommending the institution, you know, on their own platform? Are they doing things that when you're happy as a, I mean, I hate doing this, but as a customer, you know, for whatever business or anything that you support, you're engaged with those companies because on some level you feel a connection to it. And so with higher ed becoming just such, I mean, and depending on the campus you're at, bigger and bigger and bigger, you can feel a lot less connected without using these technologies that could connect folks in ways that we just couldn't do before. And so when you and at events we try and do this, and whether it's in our facility or beyond, and I just think when students feel that connection, and many of you who've gone through a 2 or 4 year educational process, you know, when that call comes from the alumni base to say, hey, we're calling to check up on your information and make sure it's correct. And now we want to know about whether can you donate to the institution. And that feeling of connected and engagement, I think, contributes to that overall satisfaction process. Right.
So here you go. This is 35 plus years of engagement research condensed onto one slide. All right. So academic engagement. So that's engagement in academic work and the academic experience. Well, I won't read this for you because there's another question.
Yeah, did you want to answer? You'll be our last question.
Yeah, you can be our last question. But you can read this, and if you want more info, then I can share with you some of the meta-analyses of this research if you want to read them. But this is a much more, I think, easy to digest way to get the info.
I guess
is this what you were asking?
Your last question space. We have time for one more. I know we're going to get kicked out in 2 minutes. Are you going to ask your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Yep, the Twitter study, and this is a admitted limitation to our work, and we are looking for funding to expand our work. I know there were some people capable of doing that in the room before. I don't know if they're still here. But one of the things we know is that increasing engagement for minority students, students from low SES backgrounds, and first-generation students improves all of these outcomes more than just majority students. So they get a bigger boost from being engaged, right? The Twitter study, in terms of diversity, very homogeneous group. You can read about the breakdown in our papers. I don't have that here. The very homogeneous in terms of racial ethnic diversity. SES pretty, you know, not as much variability. We still have some lower SES in there. First generation, some, but not like some of the Facebook research which I've shared on the bigger samples. But even that, I think we need some more diversity in. So that's definitely an issue. Great question. In our Twitter study, when we implemented the Twitter intervention, only one student had ever been on Twitter before but wasn't currently using Twitter. So none of them had used Twitter before we did it. That was part of the fun, right, to integrate it, you know, from the get-go.
And we're going to get kicked off the stage, but we're going to hang out outside if anyone wants to chat.
Thanks, everyone, so much.
One great question we want to ask you. Tell us what we need to research next, please. We need new ideas. Thank you.
Thank you so much, everyone.
Thanks.